Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by my co-host, Brian Brushwood.
Oh, hello, Andrew Main.
And Aubrey Sitterson.
Hey, boys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here, as always. And I think we have a special guest, Jason Robert Ng.
You know, I'm really, this is just the final disrespect, you know, from this. You know, I give my heart and soul here. I mean, we bring on Aubrey Sitterson, whose podcast, Scald, is one of my favorite listens. And within seconds, just because he's got such luxurious flowing locks, I just get cast aside.
I took it down for you guys because I knew I didn't know we were going to be video. And so it was up, but I took it down because I wanted you guys to get the full Aubrey experience.
Well, mainly it's an audio podcast, so you might have to just rub it across the microphone filter.
Well, but you guys can see me. And that's, that's something.
And right? It's already affected the energy of the show. You know, let's be honest here.
There was a Kids in the Hall sketch where like a bunch of mechanics and one guy had like long, luxurious locks and it was like a source of pride in the shop. You know, there
is a source of power is what it is, man. Samson. Yeah. I don't have to tell you about it. You know.
Yeah. Oh, my God. That does sound familiar. I can't remember the sketch, though. Although, by the way, my pick
Aubrey
was with Bob and David.
Because Aubrey's got awesome hair and Aubrey does a it's going to be – I think we really get into where this came from when we do the After Things podcast. But if you want to give the Justin – why don't Justin give him the short pitch?
So I've plugged it on the show before. But if you like fantasy storytelling, Conan the Barbarian, but maybe a little bit more a big world building fantasy elements, then you will really enjoy Scald. It is excellently written and narrated by our guest, Aubrey, and is something that is very easy to kind of fall into.
Well, thanks, man. That's mighty kind. That's a mighty kind explanation. I appreciate it.
Where did the idea come from?
Oh, Scald. So, you know, I have a background in comics. I used to edit Marvel Comics, and I edited Walking Dead later and stuff like that. And I do some work in comics. I get some big comics announcements. I wish it was in the past, but it's happening this week. But I wanted to have something that I could do weekly, regularly on my own. I try to do web comics, but I'm not an artist. So I had trouble finding somebody who could actually stick with it and not get a better offer or get bored or, lazy.
So, they're the worst.
Scald is something – it's a comic book that I do myself. It's a comic book that you can listen to while you're driving. It's an ongoing serial story. And I really just wanted something I could do by myself, really.
That's awesome.
I'll tell you how much of this was fueled, or you might have some insight. You know, I recently finished Lock and Key by Joe Hill, which appeared to be.
It's a great series. I love Gabriel Rodriguez.
Yeah, correct. I loved the comic book, and then they were like, okay, well, and they were a little bit sketchy on the details, but essentially what I heard was, movie thing isn't going to happen, so we're doing a full production audio stuff. But it's like there are lines out of it that appear to be straight out of Joe Hill's script, kind of describing the scene as it's set up going into it. And then, you know, all the lines, all the dialogue are, of course, done correctly. Have you listened to it?
I haven't. It sounds like it's more of like a radio serial thing, right? Where they set the scene, they tell you what's going on.
Right.
And then there are actors that do the dialogue.
That is correct. Although in the setups, you know, it's as though they're reading straight from the screenplay.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Interesting. No, I haven't listened to that. Scald's kind of takes a similar idea, but goes in a slightly skewed direction as opposed to a radio serial type thing with sound effects and music and character actors and people popping in. It's just me. It's just me as if we're sitting around a fire and I'm telling you this story.
Yeah, I think, Brian, after things, I think I want to delve really deeply into this and, you know, find out more of the origin of this, the production, all that, because it's a fantastic medium. But right now, where do people go sign up?
Oh, it's easy. Just search for Scald, S-K-A-L-D, on iTunes or Stitcher, or scald.podomatic.com. That's what we're showing up on the screen right now. That's streaming there for everybody. Also, if you're not a audio person, I take all the prose from the original stories, and I put them up on Amazon as prose volumes, as ebooks. So you can go to Amazon right now, and there are two volumes. The second one just came out this past week. Each one collects 16 episodes of the show.
Oh, that's
fantastic.
It's something that we will get more into on After Things. But just as a little teaser, Aubrey is an absolute lunatic and records all of the episodes in one take. And we can get into why he is such a...
There's a reason. There's reasoning behind it. And we'll do that later. That's the tease.
Yeah. Listen, as somebody who's recorded audio stuff, you're still crazy. And we're going to find out why you're crazy later in the After Things show.
Gentlemen. Speaking of barbarian level mysteries and things that you see and you can't quite comprehend, one of my favorite movies of all time was Conan the Barbarian.
The Schwarzenegger one?
Never heard of it.
Awesome.
Please.
Listen, you might be a big Jason Momoa fan. I don't know. That's a fair question.
You know, I tried to watch that one, and I'm 3 minutes in, and Ron Perlman is holding a prosthetic baby that made the one for American Sniper look like high-tech, realistic-life flesh. And I'm like... Oh, God, I can't even. And that was it. No, the original, John Milius, the Basil Poledouris score, the amazing, you know, Conan the Barbarian movie. You watch that and you watch, let's say, like Lawrence of Arabia, and you have an appreciation for the fact that this world feels real when you watch that. And, you know, now whenever like there's some new fantasy sci-fi movie or whatever, I see a trailer for, I'm like, man, this looks like it's every other CGI sort of thing. And, you know, there was one I was kind of excited about, and I saw this recently, the trailer. I'm like, man, it's like they got a location permit to shoot in the Uncanny Valley. I think that the things that look real, I love. I love just the simpler stuff. Not that I'm thinking CGI. When it works great. You don't see it. But sometimes people try to create stuff that looks fake. But I want to show you images of something right now that's straight out of Conan, but it's a real thing. I sent a link to Bryce. And I had no idea this was a thing, and this was somewhat of a mystery.
This looks like some kind of limestone cathedral with these giant columns that appear ribbed. There's bands of coloration as if the whole thing was etched out of a giant single rock, but it looks like there's a civilization in the background. But everything's kind of thrown akimbo. Because you can see enough of a tree in the background to make me think that the scale, as I'm seeing this thing, is completely off.
Well, it also the columns are very, very close next to each other. Like almost from this vantage point, it looks like if you put up funhouse mirrors, you can like set up a little like funhouse mirror maze.
Yeah, straight out of like a shifty character run carnival coming to your rice harvest festival.
Yeah.
The thing that's strange to me is they're not like, you know, the stalactites, stalagmite situation where they ooze down together. It's like, it's cylinders. They look like they're stacked. Well, what is it?
That's a really good point. Like, they are shockingly, there's a little bit of beveling at the top, but outside of that, they look like maybe they're bars, like it's Satan's prison in there or something.
So there's a reservoir, Crowley Lake Reservoir in Yosemite, in California. So what happened is they built the reservoir, and after they drained part of the reservoir in 1941, they saw these 20-foot tall pillars with arches, etc.
And so much bigger than I thought.
Yeah. Oh yeah, these things are huge. And so if you're walking along and you see this thing, it looks like,
whoa, you know, as we described, whoa. Oh my God, my initial reading was correct. We're looking at a woman standing as if she's like mugging at the Parthenon. That's amazing.
So wait a minute. So this is in California, and this was effectively underwater? Like this was part of the reservoir?
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy. Did the water levels create those like weird cylinder? Like is that where the water level was at a certain time?
So just to... It's been a mystery, and to sort of like to complicate things further, when I initially read an explanation, I read it wrong, and I'm like, oh, it was some sort of waterworks project, and then I saw the other photos. I'm like, nope, I did not know what this thing was, and it is a geological phenomenon. They think that what created it was the cold water percolating down into and steam rising up, hot volcanic ash spewed out by an explosion 760,000 years ago. Now, one of the researchers looked into this, warning, his name is Randolph Flagg. For any Stephen King fans
out there. Too close for me.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe the Gates of Hell is accurate. But yeah, it was a volcanic blast 2,000 times larger than the eruption of Mount St. Helens, which created a big caldera. And with that, you had all this billions of tons of this ash and material forming down, you know, that's going to eventually form rock-like structures, but you get steam and all sorts of things going through there, so, creating weird chemical things. And this could be the only place on the planet that ever happened, by the way. You know, this could
crazy.
Be,
okay, so if I'm picturing let me see it again. Like, if I'm looking at it, I could kind of picture imagine vents of steam bubbling up, and meanwhile, ash trying to coalesce as it comes down. You could almost see it, right? Like, imagine a hot tub spa is bubbling up from reliable areas, and meanwhile, mud is coagulating in the only chunks it can, which are cylinders of non-turbulent water.
And you look above it, and you can see that they go above there, too.
Yeah.
So this, if you want to look it up, if you look up on Google Image Search for all of our audio listeners out there, Crowley, C-R-O-W-L-E-Y, Lake Columns.
Why is it called Crowley? Is it like an Aleister Crowley thing? Or?
Dude, now, oh, great. More Satan imagery.
No, not an A. Don't get crazy.
No, that's the lake, right? The lake that's next
Crowley
to it.
Crowley Lake, yeah.
Yeah.
Aleister Crowley Lake.
Mm-hmm.
So which do you feel like is the stranger geological anomaly? Now, granted, this one's novel and new to us because we haven't seen it before, but this or the sand sculpted structures you find, let's say, in eastern Utah, where the wind has carved out rocks with holes in them, balanced on giant high beam places.
Gentlemen, anybody? Anybody with a lot of hair?
I mean, this seems stranger to me, man. This seems weird. I mean, it might just be a familiarity issue, but I get that. You know, it's crazy. Like, but wind can wear things down and water can wear things down. But like, to end up with these perfectly cylindrical stacks of things, and it's not even consistent. The fact that it just exists below this larger mass. Oh, I think this is absolutely unspeakably bizarre.
Well, and what makes this interesting is that just by glancing at it, you could plausibly say, okay, a primitive civilization, right? Like, that kind of works, or some kind of artistic thing that happened over a long period of time that, some rogue artist decided to make this this kind of thing. So there's an element of human intelligence, and you could conceive of like three or four different applications of that gets you to where you are now. So the fact that it's naturally made, and therefore not either of those is kind of super odd.
So actually, I didn't think human intervention in any of the explanations that I thought. Looking at it before we got the volcanic explanation, I thought it looked like nothing more than tube worms, those columns of calcite or whatever they build. It looked animal built. Like, I could imagine 20-foot tube worms living in those things. Which is technically natural, but I would say a bit supernatural.
I mean, I guess also the fact that it has this, there's nothing good about that structure, right?
That's not good design.
It kind of dripping down, right? It almost looks like, remember in The Matrix when Neo's mouth is being sealed shut,
yes,
and he's trying to open it, and he just has that sort of gummy, like from top to bottom sort of look to it.
Yeah, man. I don't know. I feel like something about this looked very underwatery to me. At first glance, but I had the benefit of knowing as Andrew was setting it up that way. It still is super, super creepy and strange.
It's one of those things where you think about this, you look at, and I remember there's a example of a scout troop going through one of those locations you talked about where they have one of those precariously bounced rocks, and an older scout leader and some of the kids start trying to knock something over, this national landmark thing. Not a very scout-like thing to do.
Sure.
And you look at this and you're like, how many things are there like this that people found?
And we're like, that's weird. Push.
Yeah. Let's go grab, all of this thing and use this magic stonework because it's, helpful.
What was the story recently about like three Yahoos at a national park tipping over like a balanced boulder that had been there?
That was
for
the
eons?
Scout troop.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know they were a scout troop. I thought that was a different thing. Wow. Wow. Did they ever write a letter of apology to the planet?
I think they were prosecuted or something. I don't know.
One of their Eagle Scout projects is balancing it back up there, so it'll be fine.
Yeah. Again, not typical scout behavior. This is more like probably one of the scout masters is somebody's drunken dad is like, yeah, I'll go with whatever. Like, hey, let's do this. Yeah. And Baden Powell, he's not.
Yeah, it says, I guess the headline says ex-Boy Scout leaders. How about that?
Yeah.
They've been charged in some capacity.
By the way, that dude, like, just the freeze frame on that dude's face just looks like, you know, somebody for whom was looking the other way while the...
You know what? I'm going to make a confession. It's like when you're out in wilderness enough and you stumble across something, you don't know how well-beloved that thing is because, for example, confession time. I had some extra time out in the show on the way back from a show out in Colorado. We went by Red Rocks Park and I walked in and I was really, you know, there was kind of graffiti etched in all the red rocks and stuff. And I was just really, I don't know, actually kind of moved by how beautiful this rock was. And so I was like, well, let me, you know, it's got all these ledges. Let me kind of climb around on it. And as I'm standing up, it's so peaceful and quiet out there. I could clearly hear a family walking forward and an excited child say, there's a man up there. And then the father, who's like 1,000 feet away, I hear him say, yeah, that's a crime. It's illegal to climb on these rocks. You could get fined thousands of dollars. And then at which point I vanished back down into the crags of the rocks and took the long way back around to the park thing. But my point is, like, if you think you're out there in the middle of nowhere, just you and Mother Nature doesn't really care. It's other people who care about the fact that a rock is curiously balanced or that, you know, there's pipes or that, you know, they don't want my footprints on their red rocks in Colorado.
But if you're in Goblin Valley State Park, which is known for these precariously balanced rocks...
Sure.
And you decide to go knock them over.
I mean, look. I'm not defending anything.
Well, I mean, I guess part of it is that context for which we don't know, right? Because if the like welcome to Goblin State Park, like stay balanced is like what the guy says when you walk in and pay your $2, right, to get in, like then you're just gonna you're definitely looking to F some S, right?
Yeah. Wait.
Goblin State Park. Did we just get in a goblin story?
What?
Oh, damn, son.
Well, first of all, nobody knock over any of those pillars. Plus, you would have to work really hard to do so because they're apparently a foot wide and made of stone.
Wow. Also, don't let another day go by without donating to the Weird Things Patreon. Patreon.com/weirdthings is where you can support this show. Thank you to everybody who has already chipped in. It allows us to make time each and every Sunday to do not only Weird Things, but also After Things, our podcast about how to be creative in the modern era. Also, it keeps our producer, Bryce, paid and gives us the self-confidence to ask big stars like Aubrey Citizen to come on the show and chat with us.
Real quick, it's never been more important than now to donate to Weird Things, as 1/3 of our entire cast has eschewed the yoke of working for his oppressors, and one Justin Robert Young is dedicating himself full-time to entertaining you guys on the internet. So, of course, support his Jury podcast, but realize that he makes money from all his podcasts.
I would love to
further encourage folks to give to Weird Things on Patreon, because here's the thing, man. I use Patreon for my projects as well, and it's fantastic because we're in a place where people can get such niche, amazing, specific content, the exact content they want. It's because we've cut out the middlemen, right? You don't have advertisers, you don't have these big networks, but in order for that to continue working, in order for people to continue getting that content, the money has to come from somewhere. You are enabling the content you enjoy to keep happening. And that's beautiful. That's a beautiful thing, I think.
It's like a subscription to being smug and superior, to walking around just a little bit taller, knowing that it's like, hey, man, I support independent artists. What did you do?
Man, yeah, I've been being smug and superior for years for absolutely free. So I don't know.
It's about time you started paying. Yeah.
But, and I think Aubrey touched on a very interesting point there too. And that is that if you don't support us, what's going to happen with these criminal minds?
Yeah, dude. Trust me. Joe? You want Andrew Main writing books about serial killers, and that's it.
You don't want these guys hitting the street, man.
No. Big problem.
So I got a mystery for y'all.
Oh, good. I was just thinking I was going to solve a mystery.
I'd say you were going to solve it, Brian, but, you know, sure. And I got a bone to pick with you, too, sir, by the way.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. We'll save that for later.
All right, I'm ready.
Brushwood. So, in 2006, a man left a bar. His name was Davey. Frequented this bar a lot, and then he was never seen again. And he was known to sort of go off whenever he got upset and sort of disappear because he was dealing with the pain of cancer and depression. This man vanished, and they just assumed, he probably died. So the family held a funeral and published an obituary a few years ago saying that he passed away, and only God knows the time and place. So you have a mystery. This man goes off and he vanishes, right?
Did this man become the father of Justin Robert Young?
All right. Settle down.
The guy's dead. We now know he's dead. We actually found him and we found his car.
Huh. Okay. So, real quick, new detective agency. Scald Services Inc. is on the case. Dr. Scald, your two trusty assistants, Bebo and What's It, are ready to go. Me, of course, Bebo. Where should we go first, boss?
He was in the car, or the car was found separate.
Hold on, we'll find out. What's It? Can you call? Can you call the cops?
Yeah, it's me, Watson. I always do things like call the cops. Oops, forgot to pay my cell phone bill. No cops for us.
Crap.
Another What's It move.
What's It? Listen, the boss is getting mad every time you do this. Listen, Scald, I'm sorry. We don't have any cops on the line, but I can call Andrew Main. Maybe he has some insight. Andrew, what's the scuttlebutt? Like, was the car found in an unusual place?
Yes.
Like, when you say unusual, was it at incredibly high altitudes or something?
No, and I would say that it was found in a strangely public place.
Huh.
Now, if you're from South Florida and I say the name Tilly Tudor, it should evoke an interesting memory. Tilly Tudor is this woman, this grandmother who went missing and nobody quite knew what happened to her. And what she did is there's this pass, this state road, 595, and it used to be 84, that goes over kind of swamp and mangroves or whatever. Tilly had somehow gone off the road and her car fell into trees and it got stuck there. Somebody saw this happen and called the state police and said, "Hey, I think I just saw a car go off the road." Police cars went there. They look, nope, we don't see anybody. And like 5 days later, people find her and she's alive because she was drinking rainwater that like fell down from the trees or whatever. So Tilly Tudor's like an amazing survival sort of story, suspended in these mangrove trees underneath a road that millions of people go across.
A real quick timeout here. Justin, is this where the character Steve McTillitudor comes from?
I mean, certainly the name. The name was the name of Steve McTillitudor was based on
Okay, all right.
Yeah. Wait, so the car rocket up into the trees or was it like an elevated roadway and fell down
a swamp and like, you know, mangroves and stuff, so she drove over and then fell into the trees.
Gotcha.
So she was, she survived.
She didn't Dukes of Hazzard up into a tree.
No.
Man.
And Tilly Tudor, let's not.
It was weeks that she survived. It was a very, very, very long time. So
they say 78 hours, but Justin's a journalist, so I'm not.
Oh, really? Wait, was it only 72 hours? for whatever reason,
that's 3 days.
Dude, look. Hey, man. There are people who have been dead and resurrected in that time.
Oh, my God. She just died 2 months ago.
No!
98.
Wow. Wow.
So, no. 3 days. For whatever reason, I remember that being longer. But, she was...
We're old. 3 days is like 4 hours.
To them. But to us, it's like an eternity. That makes them a Green Beret in our books.
So, yeah, she was hit. She was going to 595. She got hit from behind. And her car, like, went over, and whoever did it didn't tell anybody.
Oh, my God. That's so much darker. Knowing, can you imagine being that person where it's like you rear in someone and they go flying?
You imagine being that person.
Off the road into what it looks like certain oblivion, and it's like, let's just keep on going.
Yeah, maybe.
And then you turn on the news 3 days later, and it's like, a woman with photo memories, photographic memory, and who probably remembers your license plate, you fear.
Yeah.
That's amazing. All right.
Rest in peace, Tilly.
Yeah. That's crazy that she's died.
So this guy, our missing person here, found. They were found. We found them. We found them in their car. And it's one of these things where there's the person who found it, you're like, oh, wow, that's curious. And then somebody went and did a thingy thing, and they're like, oh, wow, this is really even more kind of interesting and kind of right in our face.
So, okay, so they think he's dead. So they're
let's start where they found it.
Yeah, right? Where's the car?
So we said strangely public. So was it just on the side of the road? Was it on the side of a highway or something?
All right, I think once I tell you this, this will quickly be solved, which I'm fine with. It was found in a pond.
Okay, so usually that's like, you know, your plan to deal with the insurance fraud, right? Is you go throw it in a pond.
But with your own skeleton makes the fraud part hard.
Yeah. Did he just drive the wrong direction?
Looks like he may have just driven in there. Maybe he was drunk. We don't know. The skeleton was kind of, you know, not the best of condition because it's been there forever.
Off a pier? Or he left
like
a bar?
Like, he just drove. Like, this is a pond
like
in the middle of a funeral home, and he just drove his car up into the pond.
Wait, a pond in the middle of a funeral home?
Like the parking lot, you know, near the lot.
Okay.
Wait, and the car was there. What's funny is if it was just the body, then I'm like, well, that's a cheap, funeral parlor. They're disposing of bodies in a more economical.
The car's there.
Yeah.
But... All right, you ready for this? This is how they found it. Some dude a few days ago is up hanging up Christmas decorations on a nearby building. He looks down, and he sees, not unlike a story from the movie Gremlins, by the way, he sees this car in the pond, right? He's like, it looks like that's a car. You know, I'm up on my, when you're on a ladder, you can see a lot of things you didn't notice before.
Oh, my God.
Like, hey, is that a bald spot on Phil, you know?
And so meanwhile, he's like, who knew? There was a car there the whole time. Crazy.
Well, they call the cops, they pull the thing out, and they find a skeleton in there, and the car is registered to a missing man. And like, wait a second. We think, nope, don't know what this is. No, but so they haven't positively ID'd it yet, but they're pretty sure they think that this was that guy who went missing back in 2006. But it gets better. Want to know why it gets better?
Why?
We live in a world of information, gentlemen. Information at our fingertips.
Oh, my God. Your satellite photos. You can see it in the satellite photos.
You can see it in Google Maps.
Whoa.
An effing car right in the middle of the pond on Google Maps.
Oh my God.
Crazy.
That's real quick. Can we give out the coordinates to anyone who wants to play at home?
That's from a news article. If you type in man and car missing since 2006 found in lake,
the address was
on Jalopnik. We had the link to the news article.
Yeah, Jalopnik has the addresses 2237 84th Street Southwest in Missouri.
Oh, that's amazing.
Man, talk about the show me state.
Dude. I mean, how far off are we from a future where there's, right now, obviously, you know, most satellite stuff is all government based and or licensed. You know, they do commercial sweeps here and there. You know, you watch a television shows like 24 and they act like they got up to the minute satellite coverage of the entire planet and can go there. How far off are we from a network of satellites that are privately owned that anybody can lease real time satellite data to actually catch? Like, for example, you know, I would imagine that if somebody was covering, we'll just say the United States, and say, hey, we can give you satellite level imagery, real time photos taken every 5 seconds of the entire planet. If you're in the middle of an investigation, we subscribe to our service and you can exonerate yourself, et cetera. Like, is that available yet or around the corner?
I'm just saying, like, right now you can go look at this on Google Maps itself, and it's really spooky, you know, to obviously this is, you know, the car is now gone, but to look at Google Maps and to see you're looking at the
final resting place of this poor J.O.
Yeah. To your question, Brian, like, yeah, I mean, that's getting, I think that, I don't know if that would be the first application for having that kind of real-time sort of data, but that certainly is the plan of a lot of these companies that are looking at what can happen when you start putting up your own satellites. So one of the immediate things that's being done now is you have hedge fund investors that are looking at factories in China to see, are they really running? You know, how busy are the shipping yards? What are the outputs going to be? What's the secret knowledge that we can access? And then farm reports, things like that, as Matthew McConaughey showed us in Interstellar, you know, what you can do when you capture a drone. There's all of these different applications that range for that. And when it gets down to, you know, the personal sort of thing, you know, you see that with, like you said, you know, dash cams and stuff on one level, is it certainly applies for traffic data to see what happens. But the curious thing with this is that the information was there, but we didn't have an ability to process all those images and look for that. One of the most interesting features on Mars is this Martian skylight that leads into this big cavern that I think was discovered by some middle school students that were combing through these images. Wow. And you think NASA would be the first one to say, hey, look what we found. But, you know, we still don't have the technology to parse through that stuff and say, hey, look at this.
I know there's already the growing ring of space detritus that kind of like rotates around the Earth now. Like, because every time a spaceship goes up or a satellite or anything like that, like, is there a ceiling that we're approaching for just there being too much nonsense floating around the Earth in terms of satellites and garbage and things like that?
It's a growing concern, but one is you build your systems to be more robust. We track just about every single object that's up there and we move out of the way. And you're reaching a point where it will become cost effective. What actually will be, you will be able to capture that when you get lower cost missions to orbit. Then you can build things that intentionally intercept it. So
because as soon as it becomes viable for, you know, non-government entities to start shooting things up there with any kind of regularity, it's going to explode.
But that kind of solves the problem, right? Because then you can also send things up there that capture and destroy.
Fair enough.
It seems like it's a technological arms race, right? Well, it's like the mere fact that we're able to get to orbit so easily makes it profitable to clean up everything, which is weird.
We just had a bit of space debris crash this week, a few days ago. We don't even know what it was. We have guesses, you know.
How big was it?
Let's pull this up. We type in space debris crash.
Weird space junk falls to Earth on Friday the 13th.
Whoa. Yeah. This is my new business idea, by the way, space salvage.
The Russians have actually proposed doing that. You know, if we pay them, they'll go up there and they'll collect it. But you know, the economics of space are going to just change radically the next 10 years. Besides just SpaceX, you have Blue Origin, Jeff Bezos' company, which is announced that they're going to start trying to do more suborbital stuff, which
do you think that we're looking at a potential like tragedy of the commons situation where it's like, what's the profit motive to be the guy that cleans up space? It's like, if I say, it seems to me like everyone's just going to go up, shoot their own rockets. And if I'm a company, I would rather invest $100 million on, you know, object avoidance technologies than throw $100 million into some kind of massive cleanup fund.
Well, that's the billion-dollar question, is that primarily you're going to probably have, you know, the United States and other first-world nations that are looking at, when does it become cheaper when we figure out a way to clean it up than just trying to keep avoiding it? And
are you just allowed to litter in space now? I mean, are there no international regulations against leaving stuff up there?
But,
Well, and that's a good question, right? Because, like, you know, as would it be a form of intergalactic terrorism to just go up and just explode nails everywhere and just?
I think that if you're intentionally trying to interfere with the orbits of other things, then I'm sure there's some sort of weird space maritime laws or applications to that effect, and you keep track of trajectories and orbits because you don't want to interfere with somebody else. And if you put something in an trajectory of somebody else's object, then that's attacking it. You know, that is, you are doing that.
So,
you know,
so
you
have to be sanctioned to launch stuff into orbit, right? Let's say we wanted to put stuff into orbit now, right? Like, do we have to file that with somebody?
Oh, as Americans, yeah, the FAA, we have to go through all of that. We need permission to do that.
But, like, China doesn't ask our permission before
they
launch anything
out. Americans.
Sure,
so
yeah. But, so let's say that a sizable hub of the new booming business of sending stuff into space is from America. You know, I could see that might be part of the regulation. Is like, hey, also you got to kick in this, you know, clean up our mess space tax. That we're going to, NASA would take the lead in trying to eliminate stuff if it becomes a problem, in trying to avoid it, because so much stuff is going up.
So it seems like in 2002, the IADC, the Interagency Space Debris Coordination Committee, which looks like a multinational group, released guidelines that boiled down to a lifetime limit of geosynchronous orbit of below 25 years. Satellites launched in 2008 or later are required to be deorbited or moved into a graveyard orbit beyond geosynchronous orbit at the end of their life or the maximum of 25 years.
But they, I mean,
but
these
that's
are
guidelines.
All, yeah, yeah, they're all like, I mean, you might as well, you call them guidelines, I call them wishes. It's like,
I mean, NASA's a part of
it. It's funny,
of
it reminds me of, like, you know, how things were before we had a real clear idea, we as a people had a real clear idea of the sea, right? You could just, whatever you had, whatever garbage, whatever you know, just throw it to the sea, whatever. The sea's massive. It doesn't matter. Just throw it out there. It's fine. The sea will take care of it. And we've learned that's not the case, right?
Right.
Well, there's got to be a point at which this becomes problematic, because I mean, even if you get permission to shoot your rocket up there, I mean, the rockets the United States send up leave things in orbit all the time, don't they?
To make something that's going to stay in orbit is a little bit more tricky, and things eventually tend to fall down because the atmosphere goes much further out than we think. And that's like what this is saying. Okay, orbit, it's got to be low enough or have an elliptic to it that's going to eventually bring it down in 25 years,
and then most of it will just get burned up in the atmosphere and
re-entry, but a lot of it doesn't,
right?
There's wrenches and things like that. They're tracking things that track, you know, like, oh, on this Russian launch in 1993 they lost a wrench and this thing is still in orbit because it was up up high enough to do that. There are a lot of things, and dead satellites and stuff, like, there's a ton of debris up there, rivets, things like that, and they frequently have to move the International Space Station back and forth to adjust for that. And so those are real, you know, 25 years eventually means it'll go away, and that's to stop the accretion of that stuff beyond a certain point. But yeah, you know, we're gonna, you know, there have been plans, the Russians proposed a plan, but all this changes if we get reusable rockets, to bring it back to that particular refrain.
Changes it insofar that it becomes like super cheap to just go up and let's place a satellite while we're here. Let's catch this nut. Hey.
And also, like, that is something where it's like, you know, if it's like, all right, so where's the profit motivation to collect stuff? Like, it's in government contracts, right? Like, you want to be that dog catcher where some, you know, where government or government say, hey, it's easier for us to get things into orbit if there is less of this kind of debris up there. And so
if you're Elon Musk and you team up with Google to put up a constellation of low Earth orbit satellites that Neil deGrasse Tyson says can't exist, that are going to be providing communications. I'm
Shots
still
fire.
Bitter about his review of Gravity.
Shots fire.
You know, to provide, you know, to sweep the internet, sweep the world with internet global communications, and you've got thousands of these things. You're going to be like, you know what, like, when does it become cheaper to build, you know, some big piece of foam block that we move around with little, you know, ion jets that's going to capture all the stuff throwing new satellites?
It's so funny you mentioned that, because that's what I was wanting to talk about. Was when I was a kid, must have been like 12 years old, I was reading 3-2-1 Contact magazine, where they were talking about cleaning up
3-2-1 Contact is the moment.
with everything. Sorry.
So there was a lot of stuff talked about. One, you know, like you said, a giant block of foam. But then in that same article was talking about there was a proposal at one point by France to celebrate an anniversary that by inflating a giant ring of basically because it would be so close to Earth, this thing would be as bright as a full moon for the entire year until it fell down and burned up. And then basically they were going to do it just to say, you know, hooray, vive la France or whatever. And I'm thrilled that we're entering an era where any nutty scheme will become possible because it'll be so cheap to get to orbit. But also, are we looking at an unprecedented age of just crap in our sky, ruining our view?
You're gonna deal with a big backlash, though. And so if you decide that you're going to go out and you're going to light up the sky at night, every single astronomer in the world, and as we know, they're not the most even tempered of their scientists in some regards, you're going to deal with, you know, a lot of complaining like that and criticism. When I was a kid, I used to think, man, what if I put a bunch of like solar reflectors or whatever on the moon and I just turn the moon into a big TV?
or blasted lasers at the moon and broadcast, you know, drink Coke on there.
Yeah, I think that would cause a lot of problems for the Coke PR department. There was Pepsi had talked about,
which is why Pepsi will do it.
No, Pepsi had actually looked at
the choice of a new generation.
Yeah, there was, and it could have been just a PR stunt to say that it was a PR stunt. But I remember Pepsi was talking about that, but it's just, it's like, no, you will get in this eco conscious world, you will get so super criticized for doing that.
God, that's so funny. Is it eco consciousness or aesthetic consciousness? Right, where it's like.
What's the difference, Brian?
Did we talk about the mealworms eating styrofoam in a previous episode? Do we already talk about that?
No, but do mealworms eat styrofoam?
No, that was the big discovery. I want to say like 4 weeks ago.
Yeah, we talked about it.
Okay,
we
had a whole segment about it. Well, specifically, what made me think of it was Aubrey was talking about how our attitudes used to be just throw it in the ocean is huge, but then also just like. Nowadays, you know, today we discover that mealworms can eat styrofoam and we can weaponize the bacteria and throw it on that, you know, Texas-sized chunk of plastic and maybe clean up stuff.
So that, quote, Texas-sized chunk of plastic, which doesn't quite exist the way people think, that's one of the problems we deal with is we have this
perception.
We start banning plastic bags because we don't want to contribute to the garbage bag. Well, most municipal plastic bags are never going to end up out there. And guess what? E. coli infections have gone up in every region, you know, in the regions where they ban those plastic bags because people start reusing those their bags, but they don't wash them. And there have been numerous outbreaks now of people getting very, very sick. And if you want to measure in a cost of life, those little plastic bags are actually a pretty good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, the stupid bag thing. And it's just infuriating. they've effectively banned them, like Alameda County. Where I live in Oakland, they banned them. San Francisco banned them before that.
Los Angeles, Glendale, same thing.
Yep.
Science. I mean, plus also, whenever you always open it up for weasels whenever you do that, and I understand it's well-intentioned, but in Austin, they banned plastic bags for about 20 minutes where it's like there were just no bags. They're like, here's all your stuff. Hope you got big arms. And then then 20 minutes later, they're all like, would you like to buy a totally reusable bag that is exactly as thick as the old bags that we used to give away for free? They're 50 cents. Enjoy. And it's like, okay, so it's a $2 jerk tax. That I'm paying now for.
I do use my cloth bags though.
You
better wash them.
Wash them. E. coli. Okay. Spread free.
Well, that's the thing. So, you know, people are like, yeah. Well, if you fine, then wash them. Yes, the amount of energy you use and the amount of soap you use to wash them way offsets this easily produced plastic bag made in some industrial area where we can find the impact of it.
I think there's another factor here too, though. I mean, because now there are plenty of times when I go to the drugstore or whatever, and they ask me if I want to buy a bag for 10 cents and say, no, I've just got four things. I can carry them in my arms. So I think there are plenty of times where people just don't use bags at all, right? So it's not – I don't think it's just a one or the other. People are either going to use these filth covered cloth bags or the plastic bag. You know what I'm saying?
Because of this bad science out there and this bad view that, well, oh, we're doing something good, you know, no one, you're not. Two, people are getting sick.
You don't think it's a good thing to stop using so many plastic bags?
Well, it depends. It depends. And this is a good question. Like the question of whether it's good or bad, I think, is a false dichotomy, because it depends on what in what metric you're talking about. If you're talking about economically, is it good or bad? It's highly efficient and doesn't, you know, yield whatever. Is it beneficial in so far as the number of humans affected? You know, certainly you can make a case that, well, we have an increase of E. coli, so apparently it wasn't a great thing. But is it aesthetically a better thing? It's like, well, I don't know. I go to the parks now, and there's not bags everywhere. And so, you know, it depends by what measure and which one is more important. Is it a better world? Whether or not you will ever see the alleged Texas-sized, you know, flotilla of trash, you know, just knowing it's out there, does that weigh you down in your life? And are you willing to pay some amount for the belief that you're doing something about it? But
you know, the problem is we get it. And again, yeah, absolutely right. We have to parse it. If you put a high value on human life over the aesthetic, then you'd say, oh, it's a horrible idea. We keep saying this flotilla trash. It's not what it is. I think
we're eliminating a step or two here, right? Because people aren't getting E. coli because plastic bags are outlawed. They're getting E. coli because they don't wash their shit, right?
Right, because we had this – people aren't – you know, but again, it's because we had a very, very convenient way to do this, and we're saying, you know what? People aren't good about their bags. They're throwing them away. There's this element of human behavior we're trying to correct for, and we think that they're somehow ending up in the ocean, which is not really what was happening. But therefore, they should use these recycled bags, and now we're going to expect them to take several other leaps. And the problem was is we're saying, yeah, they didn't do this, but no, they will do this now, where we have this very convenient thing that you had a less loss of life. If people brushed their teeth and did a lot of things, we wouldn't have, you know, a lot of the health problems that we do. But we just assumed, because we couldn't correct for one form of human behavior, we're going to do this other thing without thinking of the consequences are that, oh, wait, no, that'll be even more steps that people have to follow through.
Well, you keep coming back to the Texas-sized plastic flotilla. But, I mean, and I recognize that not, you know, very little of the plastic bags used in the continental United States are going to end up out there. But, I mean, isn't landfill space a concern too?
No.
Unfortunately, that's probably ixnay on the anvil lay, because that one's been fairly thoroughly debunked 8 ways from Tuesday. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Fair enough.
And it's fascinating too, because you know, nowadays the science of landfill is so good. You know, they can build them deeper. They can harvest the methane that's created from it and use it to create fuel. And then, you know, there's even an emerging class of science. You know, modern anthropologists who are doing things like digging up. They're actually very thankful that they have garbage samples from the 1970s, because they are able to actually track the use of condoms over time, because you essentially have these little packages. I mean, that's all anthropologists do, is look at you know, condoms. Dead people's garbages anyway.
We could take Ted Turner's ranch in Montana or Wyoming, and we could take 1% of it and fit all of our garbage for the next 100 years and still have plenty of room for buffalo and stuff. John Tierney, who is a writer for the New York Times, wrote a piece explaining the kind of how misinformed we were about trash, and that, you know, that was that we were, it was being treated like religion, and just debunked so many of the arguments about that. It had the record for the most hate mail the New York City ever, or excuse me, New York Times ever got. So it was New York Times Magazine.
I mean, I believe it because
came out too, October 3rd.
I mean,
that was the follow up.
Oh, that was the follow up. Gotcha.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense though too, because like, what could sound more horrific than, you know, trash everything, which is what's implied, you know?
Yeah, and it's interesting because you break it down and you understand that in some places, you know, where Japan, and you know, it's more essential to do that, but you look at the cost of recycling glass, how much it costs to transport that and move that from one place to the other, your energy costs and all that, but it becomes a religion. And some people hear it's like, ah, they're saying don't recycle, don't do this. It's like, no, it's just approach it like scientists.
Keep in mind when you say
I understand your point, but here in the Bay Area, we very much appreciate the cult of the four cans, and we separate very diligently into all appropriate bins.
Urban myth about that, though, is that like some tiny minuscule percentage of it actually gets recycled, because some of it's too dirty and some of it's a slightly different type of glass or whatever. I mean, is that accurate?
Mixed glass.
Very little of what gets sent to the recycling center actually gets recycled.
I,
Not to mention, also, like, there's difference in plastics, right? Like, certain high-density plastics don't get recycled, you know, in the same way. Although, for me and you and everybody else listening, you probably just have, oh, plastic thing. I throw it in the thing that says throw plastic here, and yet it's still going to the landfill.
Yeah, well, and at this point, and I think, I don't know, the rhetoric saying, you know, recycling is a religion or whatever, I think is unfortunately polarizing. But I think it is accurate insofar as you feel real good when you recycle, and maybe there's a value to that. And I don't know what that is, though.
I think that, you know, all these things have to be parsed, because some of it makes a lot of sense. Some of it is really practical and should be done, and there are situations where you really want to do this. I think that if you're a very responsible person, that if you're – I mean, but like with the plastic bag in the stores, it's the weird trade-off, because you're like, all right, well, I'm going to go ahead and wash my bag and not get sick. But yeah, but now you're putting extra detergent stuff in the water and you're doing this. And like, that's a trade-off that you know, when the scientist and economist that I listen to, like, have made a very good point that, like, yeah, no, it's probably worse for things. You know, that's – So I don't have any answers, but I think for all these things, we look at it by case by case, you know, thing, and we get past our knee jerk skepticism, or, you know, knee jerk decision, like, oh, this is right, and I want to be a right thinking good person, so this is what I do, and don't be afraid to ask.
And especially when it comes to laws and bans and stuff like that. Like, yeah. It's not about what's good and it's not about what's bad. It's about what passes, you know, and what we want to pass and what has the support of people that are in power. You know, that's what happens.
Gentlemen, should we jump into picks?
Yeah. With Bob and David.
Damn it.
Ha! Got you.
Are you watching? Okay, for those of you guys who don't know, there was a wonderful show back in the late 90s on HBO called Mr. Show with Bob and David, and it's back again. In many ways, Bob and David never left us. Bob Odenkirk, of course, starring in Better Call Saul and in Breaking Bad. David Cross in a billion different things, most notably yelling at Larry the Cable Guy. And, dude, what were your impressions, Justin?
You know... There was a really fun moment when Brian and I, who have been, you know, friends for years, and you know, I was in Austin a lot over the last month, but you know, we have always shared a mutual love for Mr. Show, and just this surreal moment where I can sit next to Brian and watch a new Mr. Show content was super, super fun. I've said before, you know, I'm very, like, I have such mixed feelings about our kind of pet cemetery nostalgia, you know, thing that we have now, where we're in the boom of so many more media outlets that want to create original content. The easiest way to get in that game is to bring back something that is beloved and we remember to be fantastic. Sketch comedy itself is also very, very hard and very different compared to where Mr. Show you know, was at its best in the mid to late 90s. So the degree of difficulty for them to do good content, I think, is very, very high. There, it ain't Mr. Show. It is its own thing, both in terms of style and in the fact that I think it doesn't quite have the batting average that Mr. Show had. But man, when it hits, it still has that Mr. Show fastball of being just as bizarre and biting and satirical. And if just for the fact that there are maybe no better people in the business of comedy of the angry yelling punchline than the cast of Mr. Show, between Bob Odenkirk and Jay Johnston and you know, everybody else, Brian Posehn and David Cross and everything. They're just so, so, so good. It's so funny. And it was delightful. There are a few lines and sketches in there that are just, like, you know, blow your head off your shoulders, hilarious. So,
oh, dude, the country music video one, the Don't Need Much, was note perfect. Like, at some point, Bob and David's infatuation with mocking country musicians and country music, and showing their rage by exquisitely aping it. Is like, at some point, it's like, look, why don't you get a room with country music? Since clearly you hate it so much, you love it. And yeah. It's amazing.
It's a country music song that through the first half is just an effective country music song. Like, it just is something that would be on CMT, and then kind of takes this very subtle and funny turn. All I have to say is I love you all equally, and I'm an amazing mom.
Yes. One quick nod before we move on that. Did you watch the fifth episode, the behind the scenes documentary?
No, I haven't yet. No,
I'm about halfway through it right now. It's wonderful because you see the creative process as it's happening. You see the fuzzy ideas that they have and the gentle arguments they have about what would be better between A and B, and then you see the final product intercut with it. It's a fantastic insight to the creative process. So argue with that, jerk. Dude, my pick is got to be Return. It's not a perfect pick. I give a grudging and yet heartfelt pick to a flawed release that that in many ways has fallen very, very short of its promises, insofar that it was supposed to work, but it doesn't. Fallout 4 is a very, very buggy game running on an ancient engine, and yet it is staggering in its ambition. It is wonderful for what it's trying to do. I am optimistic that moving forward, it will eventually work on my computer, either any of my computers.
It's literally not working?
Well, I mean, I get to play for about 20 minutes before, as if I'm entering a fever dream, all of a sudden there'll be a neon pink tree. And then I'll turn around and there'll be two neon pink trees. And then there'll be a weird plaid fluorescent garbage everywhere. And then everything gets corrupted and then the game crashes. And plus on top of that, there's bugs in the quests. There's bugs in the execution. It's the looping animations are kludgy. All of that I will acknowledge. However, it is also incredibly ambitious and detailed and real a world. I am enjoying my delve into Diamond City to join up with the mysterious stranger to build sanctuary and so on.
It took a while. It's a slow burn.
Yeah,
it is. It took me about 8 hours to actually feel into the game.
It took me about 10 hours. I would say it's not friendly to, like, Grand Theft Auto 5. I still have not really finished any of the real quest dynamics. I just run around and blow stuff up, and that's great, and it rewards you for that. Fallout is less rewardy of it, especially when it crashes every 20 minutes. But it was really good. I'm glad it exists, and I look forward to diving into more.
Brian, I want you to entertain the thought that perhaps your experience is some sort of divine punishment.
For playing this game? For not getting work done?
No, for your betrayal to me.
Oh, wait, what do you mean? When did I betray you?
Brian.
What did I do?
Brian, how callously you would say that. How you just sort of dismissed the idea that you could have betrayed me and pretend to have no idea. Oh, how could I have betrayed you, Andrew? I would never betray you or admit to it or acknowledge it, the grievous harm that I have done to you.
What was it? What did I do?
I had a conversation yesterday with our mutual friend, Tom Merritt. I won't name names. I had a conversation yesterday with somebody we all know. And I brought something up, and he's like, oh, yeah, no, we love that. Like, yeah, we showed that to Brian. Brian loves that, too. I'm like, nobody. I had to find this on my own and discover this.
Oh, no. What did I fail to share
and
with
Brian's
you?
Brian's been using this all this time, and he didn't call me up and tell me about this?
Oh, I failed you. How did I do?
I thought we were friends. I thought we were buddies, but no, apparently. When I find out something cool, I try to call my friends. And maybe I've had people like, oh, why didn't you tell me? Like, oh, that's when you didn't pick up. I was trying to tell you.
Oh, Brian, that's really screwed up, man.
Andrew, I want you to know that
That was really, I mean, it just kind of changes things.
I went through a very selfish period recently, and there was a brief period that I didn't call. I mean, I called everyone else. I didn't call you. And I'm very sorry about that. And it's only because you refuse to put all your books out on audiobook, and I need you to read the next five of them to me in order for me to start sharing again.
You're not just placing this onto me, okay? I'm gonna do everybody else. I'm not gonna pull a Brian on all of you, and I'm gonna tell you what this is. This has been a life changing thing. This is why when Steve Jobs went on stage with the iPhone and said, "This is what it's an internet communicator. You know, it's a phone. It's an iPod. Right? It's also blank." And it would have all the sales that the iPhone has now, they would have had like 8 years ago.
Uh-oh.
I'm talking about this thing's changed my life. It has changed my life. I'm not saying for the better, but it has changed my life.
I hope this is Candy Crush.
Better. The Taco Bell app.
Oh, my God! Dude! I tweeted it to the world! I'll tell everyone a million times over! It is life-changing!
What does it do? I don't even know.
Yes!
So, imagine this. Imagine you stroll into a Taco Bell like a pimp, right? And you don't go to the line. You just sit down on a chair, and they say, Andrew, your order's ready. And people in line look at you like, what? You didn't even order. How did you do this? And then you go pick up your tray, and what's on your tray? Oh, maybe it's a nacho, but maybe a nacho with bacon. Maybe a nacho with potatoes on it. Maybe an entirely customized meal that everybody else stares at there and can't even fathom. Like, where is this on the menu? And you're like, oh, no. It's not.
Oh, wait.
This
so you tell me,
creation.
Like, what if you went to Taco Bell and instead of getting, you're like, I want a taco minus the taco and also take away all the meats and cheeses and add a whole bunch of lettuce, tomato, onions, salsa, and beans and jalapenos. Basically, just make me a healthy salad. And they're like, well, we don't do that. And you're like, well, you do now because that's my recipe that I just put on there.
Can I tell you where this app sounds like it falls down on the job?
What?
You still have to eat Taco Bell.
Yeah!
You're still damn eating Taco right Bell.
Cut his mic. Cut
done.
His mic.
Done. It is. So what you go on there, and you can take, and like my favorite thing is like I'll go into like the dollar menu and I'll take a dollar menu nacho and I'll turn it into a $2 nacho. You're like, how good can a $2 nacho be? Let me tell you what, hella better than a $4 nacho if you know what you're doing. What's that?
This is some hacking the system stuff here. Hold on, let me get ready.
I add bacon and everything. You go in there and you can just totally redo everything you want, and it will save your favorite stuff. So that when you go back and you're like,
there's got to be a forum, right? Like, there's got to be like a forum where everybody has their own creations.
There are three different subreddits on how best to hack the Taco Bell menu.
What's funny to me is there's two Taco Bells near me. Not that I'm bragging, guys. They're both about a mile and a half away. One slightly closer. I go there, and it's very authentic because nobody there speaks English. And they're kind of good at the orders, although I'll ask for like one taco with red sauce, one taco with chipotle sauce, and they'll put chipotle and red sauce on both of the tacos. Which is not as good as it may sound. But anyhow, I went into that one, and I'm like, hey, I got the mobile app. I asked the girl behind the counter, like, how many times a day does somebody come in here with one of these? She says, once a week.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
I go to the Taco Bell up the road a mile, and I walk into there. I'm like, how many times do you guys have somebody come in? They're like, I don't know, a dozen times a day, more. I'm like, really? Go, yeah, we're right next to a high school.
I didn't tell you the first time I tried this, I went in and I was trying to figure out if I could get this kind of salad thing made. And you know, it's that awkward conversation and we have to sage thing and you don't know all the options that are available. It's like, okay, I want this, but take away blank, 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 and blank, blank. Like, so just beans and salsa. And I'm like, yeah, pretty much. And then they give it to me. And then I was like, I'm going to try that app thing. And I put it in and I just said yes to so many extras on there that I was like, and I'll take two of those and send now. And yes, I'm here to receive it. 30 seconds later, from across the counter, I hear an honest to goodness, like not thinking about it, a response of like, what the? and then I was like, yes. And sure enough, 3 minutes later, it's like, Brian, I got this, whatever it is.
I make a show when I go in there of filling out their surveys and give them really positive reviews.
Oh,
so
that's a good call.
They see me. I've actually had them. I won't name restaurants, but I will say a place that rhymes with taco smell may have asked me. They're like, hey, can you fill out these other three surveys for us too? You know, and we'll give you free stuff. And I'm like, keep your free stuff. Not everything has to be a transaction for me. Just the next time you see this face, make it good.
Hey, listen, I'm not a hero, folks. You know, sure, if you want to ascribe that to me, that's your business. But I am just a humble servant.
Aubrey, do you have any picks?
I do. Yeah, I actually do. It's a band. Brian, you're an Austin guy, right?
Yes, I am.
So they are from your neck of the woods. They're called the American Sharks. And they're a metal band, but they're not – like it's a very – a lot of the metal I listen to isn't super accessible, but this is. It's like scuzzy. Yeah, there it is. It's like scuzzy party metal. I first saw them open for The Sword, which is also from Austin, but they're out on tour with Gwar as well. All their songs are like 2 or 3 minutes long. It's all about partying and drinking beers and smoking weed and Satan. Also, there's a lot of Satan talk, but it's really fast, hard, like fun punk influenced metal.
American
great
Sharks.
Videos on YouTube, and it's on Spotify too. Their only full length album. It's self-titled, and everybody should buy it and listen to it on Spotify and go see them on tour, because I want a dozen more of these albums.
They're performing on Saturday, December 5th in Austin, Texas, at the Canned Festival in Austin, Texas, at 4 p.m.
You'd be a fool to miss it, Brian. I'm telling you.
Hey, so as a metal aficionado, am I liked more or less on your radar for being a fan of baby metal? Is that like a gauche thing among metal fans?
You know, some people really look down there. It's not for me. I don't like it, but I don't dislike you. Because you're like,
well, thank goodness I can sleep tonight.
Like you're still okay by me, Bushwood.
All right, good.
No, I mean it is anything that's very shticky in the metal, like, has its detractors.
So like Dragon Force is too,
for sure,
or
for sure.
Or...
Ghost also, I love Ghost. They're one of my favorite bands, but they are very shticky, and the camp is a huge part of it. And so they have their detractors too.
But is there any camp in American Sharks?
Not really. No, it's just grungy and dirty and fast and fantastic.
Awesome.
I have a plug.
Go.
I got up last night, make sure I could get this through so I could talk about it on these microphones right here, right now. I have a brand new novella out.
What? Did you write it in 24 hours? I learned how to do that from your book.
I did the first draft in 24 hours.
Wow.
I spent considerably longer on the second draft, because when you write something in 24 hours, you need to then sit down and edit. So
the last line is like, and then hit send, the end.
Done. So I wrote a novella. It's called Game Night. And what I did was I took a version of this and I gave it out to people who responded to a PS on my email list. And I gave them the free copies. And I had a little survey, a little Google Doc that they could then go in and give me notes on mistakes, what their thoughts were and all that. And the number one note was, man, like, there's a lot of swearing in this first chapter. So I didn't get rid of all the F-bombs, but I did dial back the F-bombs considerably. But I put a guy in a very realistic situation who I thought, like, yeah, this guy's going to be swearing because he's scared. But I did tone down the language by, like, maybe 50 or 60% to that regard there, and made my edits and all that thanks to all the people that contributed that. And then today, it is now available on the Amazon store. It is 100 pages, you know, in the Kindle version, so it's a quick read. Justin, you look like you're about to say, are you upset that I took out the F-bombs?
No. Oh. I mean, having read the novella and given my notes on it, I think that I can understand where people would find it jarring, although I will warn anybody that if you have a problem with some of the F-bombs in the first chapter, there are some themes and situations that happen in the chapters thereafter.
Are they adults in nature?
Yeah, it's HBO. I mean, it's very it's violence, and there's sex and violence in there. I describe it as sort of Fight Club meets Game of Thrones. It's the premise is, well, I'll read you the description, ladies and gentlemen, since you asked. The first time they came for Kevin, he woke up in a forest on the edge of town with a sword and only seconds to save his life before a lunatic with a battle axe nearly split his skull. At first, he thought it was a dream. Then it became a living nightmare as he found himself night after night having to fight in abandoned shopping malls, dark alleys, and swamps on the outskirts of civilization. The rules were simple. They could come for him anytime they wanted. And if he resisted, someone close to him would die. A twisted clash of Fight Club and Game of Thrones, where the only way to survive is to never stop playing. That's the premise.
Dude, that's fantastic.
It is exceptional. I'm very, very excited for Andrew to have something out there for people to just go and take a look at. So I having read it, man, I devoured it in about 2 hours, 2.5 hours, maybe a little bit longer. And It was an absolute awesome, awesome tear through it read. So I would say everybody go check it out. Game Night, KNIGHT.
Totally nothing to do with night school, which is more juvenile. I just, yeah. You know, I very limited imagination when it comes to titles or plots. we're going to try to do an audiobook with Justin doing it if he has the time. And other note, too, is, by the way, thanks to all the support, my booklet, How to Write a Novella in 24 Hours, is still hovering in the top 10 on books on writing.
Congratulations.
On Amazon.
Oh, sweet.
So that's been just a consistent, I think, keeps doing it, keeps staying up there. And, you know, it was like number 7 yesterday. I think it maybe right now I'm looking at it number 9. So wow. That's turned out
that's
well.
Amazing.
The reviews have been great. It's already at 30 reviews. If you like anything any of us do, Aubrey's podcast, Justin's podcast, his books, Brian's podcast and books, his YouTube videos, all that, please, please, there are thousands of listeners to this podcast. And if we had 1% of the people who are listening, and that means don't be, you know, the 99 waiting for somebody else to do it. If you do this, if you go in there and there's something you really like and you want to share and you tell people about it, it means as much as when we ask for, like, hey, if you can financially support us or whatever, every time you put a vote and you say, hey, I really like this, I really dig this, it helps a lot.
Disproportionately. And, so, I mean,
yeah,
like
yeah. In fact, if you were to say, what would you rather have to any of us? $1 on the Patreon that would charge for each episode, or that without fail, every single time there is a new project for which I buy and like, I'm still speaking from the point of view of the person, that we would honestly rate and review it, we would say, keep your dollar, Holmes. You just go ahead and check it out, and review it, and give it a good rating based on your honest opinion, because yep. That is huge.
Oh, that's why I have an email list, you know, which is getting bigger and bigger. I gave out Game Night free. I sent it out again free again because it's like, hey, if you like me enough to subscribe to my email list and you like me enough, you like my stuff enough to read what I have to say. I don't want – yeah, I would love it if you bought my book at $1 so I can get it up at the sales chart. But what I really want, if you're one of these people that loves my stuff, I want you to tell other people why you love it so people who are reading reviews can decide if it's for them. You know, I can't write stuff that everybody's going to love. I know that. But people who like my stuff, who tell other people why they like it, the same with anything else other of us here do, that's what means the most. So if you can do that, oh, my God. I mean, that is – it is helpful. And we're not asking like – don't lie. If there's a thing that we do that's not your thing, then, yeah, you know, you can take a pass. But if there's a thing you're passionate about, tell people.
Yep.
That's all I have to say. So thank you for your support.
Give us your words.
Agreed.
Yeah. Keep your dollars.
So, ladies and gentlemen, we're coming to the end here of Weird Things. We're going to do our After Things podcast, which is a little nice little bonus for our Patreon.
Jumbo-sized episode this week. I mean, I'm super excited to hear about the whole process of how Scald came to be and the creative behind it.
It is. I can't wait because what our guest Aubrey is doing is it kind of creating his own sort of little genre here and his own little thing of what he's doing, which I'm excited to do. So we're going to take a break from Weird Things and call it an end. We're going to say it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.